We wrapped up a few minutes early, so we actually have 10 minutes till class starts. Oh. Till 10 minutes till class starts. Hey, that's good. I won't have to talk as loud. Can y'all hear me okay back there? All right. I feel like I'm ringing. Turn my hearing aids down. So we have a few minutes until we start, but it's quieting down and people are making their ways in. We have a number of guests here today, and we want you to know that we're glad to have you. We're in the middle of a study about the big picture of the Bible. Now, if you're going to cover the Bible in one quarter, that means you're going to move pretty fast, right? And I hear Jordan has said that several times so far, and when he asked me to fill in for him, he gave me his notes. For today, there are 7 pages of notes. That's moving fast. So we're going to kind of zip along. There's a huge advantage to having one of these big picture of the Bible studies. And one of the things you will see that Jordan has weaved through every single lesson is thoughts about how we see Jesus. You see, we began in Genesis with the fall of man. And with that fall of man, God made a promise. And what we see playing out in the Bible is really God bringing his plan, his promise, to fulfillment. And so what we want to do as we zip through this is, unlike what we do a lot of times where we get down and we inspect not the forest, not the grass under the forest, but the pebbles of soil under the grass. We're going to raise ourselves up, and we're going to get in our little helicopter, and we're going to fly above the forest, and we're going to see the big picture. And we're going to see how God has blessed man, how he had a plan for man that began before the foundation of time and carried all the way through to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, the establishment of the church, and ultimately through Revelation. And it's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful picture. And it's incredible that we get the opportunity to just come from a high level and see Jesus woven throughout the whole Bible. So I guess we've quietened down enough. Let's go ahead and dive into today's lesson. When we hit if you will turn to Exodus chapter 1, you'll be ready. When we hit the end of Genesis and we go to the next page to Exodus chapter 1. If you remember old VCRs, whenever you used to hit the super fast forward button where, I mean, you couldn't see anything. Well, the Bible takes a super fast forward and they released the thumb on that super fast forward long about verse 4 of Exodus chapter 1, and you see the tapes gradually slow down. And so time is highly compressed at the beginning between Genesis and the first few verses of Exodus 1. And it stays fairly fast up until we hit long about Exodus chapter 3, which is really the third period of Moses' life. So a lot of time is going by. Now, leading into Exodus, I want to start by recollecting a verse that Jordan talked about back when we were studying in the life of Abraham. In Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13, remember that God told Abraham, he said, "Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions." Now I want you to listen. This is Abram. So we got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Now we have the period of captivity. We have all these years. And so back in Abraham's early days, God tells Abraham, look, there's a plan I have. And it's all a part of this promise that he made to him. And God says several really key things, that his offspring will be in a land that's not theirs, the land of Goshen. They will be servants there. And we're going to see in the beginning of Exodus chapter 1 that this Pharaoh makes them slaves. And they will be afflicted for 400 years. And we're going to see the level of affliction that arises. And he says, I'm going to bring judgment. And we know about Moses and Pharaoh and the plagues and the judgment that came. I'm going to bring judgment on the nation they serve. And afterward, they shall come out with great possessions. And we know that in the end, Pharaoh said, get out of here. And when they left, they plundered Egypt. And they left with mighty possessions. All of these promises that God made to Abraham come true in the first half of the book of Exodus. And most of them in what we're going to study today. All right? Actually, all of them. The other key thing that we need to remember is God made Abraham three promises. You remember what those were, right? What's one of them? You have to speak up. I'm hard of hearing. I heard land. Okay, I heard nation and seed. All right? What we see in the beginning of Exodus is one of those promises fulfilled. The nation. So when they come out of the land of Egypt, when they go to the land of Egypt, during the famine, Jacob and his family were about 70 people. When they leave Egypt, there are about 1 million people. 600 men. 400 years. That's some prolific multiplying, right? About 1 million people. This is the nation that God promised Abraham fulfillment. They haven't made it to the land yet. And the seed that ultimately blesses all mankind doesn't come until we get to Jesus. But we certainly see that fulfilled here. But the beginning of Exodus is a very dark period for God's people. They've moved to Egypt. The famine's ended. In time, Joseph and all of his brothers die. We see that in Exodus 1, verse 6. And the family continues to grow. And they filled the land. Verse 7 says, they became exceedingly mighty. And in the passing of time, the pharaohs passed and new pharaohs arose. And finally, time had gone so far that the pharaohs no longer remembered the famine and all that Joseph had done for them. And they weren't quite as sure of themselves. And so a new king arose in Egypt who did not know Joseph, in verse 8. And the kindness that was expressed to the Israelites under those previous pharaohs came to an end. The new pharaoh was afraid of the growing population of Israel, we see in verses 9 and 10. And he chose then to enslave them, thinking maybe that by enslaving them and working them, they would be too tired to multiply. It would stop their growth and prevent them from rising up against Egypt. It did not. In fact, they continued to grow and to spread out and added further to the fear of the Egyptians, as you see in verse 12. Pharaoh then commanded that the midwives kill the Hebrew babies. I'm going to give you a little hint because I forgot to say this at the beginning. At the end of the class, we'll talk some. And what we're going to talk about is where you see Jesus in the story of the Exodus. So where I stop to remind you of that might give you a little hint of one of those. So Pharaoh commanded the midwives to kill the Hebrew babies. Obviously, if we kill off a whole generation of males, then that kind of slows down the growth, right? And so he commanded that they'd be thrown into the Nile. Well, We've had 400 years of harsh, cruel conditions, enslavement to the Egyptians, and in their oppression and bondage, they cried out to God for deliverance. And God brings onto the scene a man named Moses, who during this time of adversity and hardship would become one of Israel's greatest leaders ever. He is born to a family in the tribe of Levi, and his parents chose to hide him. And they made a homemade boat, and we know the story. They put him on the banks of the Nile, up in the rushes, and along came Pharaoh's daughter and found him, and said, "Oh, look at that, a new play pretty," and adopted him. But she needed a nurse. Pharaoh's sister happened to be standing by and says, "I know somebody." Moses' sister, sorry, interpret what I mean. Moses' sister was standing by and said, "You know what? I know somebody." Went and got Moses' mother and said, "She can nurse him." And so Moses' mother actually had the opportunity to nurse and raise Moses, even though the daughter of Pharaoh had adopted him. Anyone remember what Moses' father and mother's name were? Amram and Jochebed. You know when, is he back there? I'm not going to embarrass him. Good. When Josh was little, one of the first Bible facts he came out with was Amram and Jochebed. And I was like, where is that? I turned over to Exodus to find it. It's not there. You got to go elsewhere. But that was one of his first Bible facts. He's not back there. I didn't embarrass him. So we have Moses pops up on the scene. There's an interesting thread through the Exodus of threes. Things happen in threes, groups of threes. We see things sort out that way. And Moses' life is divided up into three segments of 40 years each. And the first segment, we just have a snapshot, about 10 verses that covers that. He grows up in the royal palace. He's exposed to what at that time would have been a world-class education, instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, we're told in Acts 7:22. But remember, his mother was still there. And she was trying to counter the pagan upbringing. And she was successful. And that's a pretty amazing thing to think about in our time, because there's a lot of people trying to teach our children a lot of really bad things. But we can be the rock that teaches them from the Word, and they can learn what they need to fight all the error in the world today. His own mother countered that upbringing so that he also learned about the one true God of his people. And he saw the terrible plight of his brethren. And when he was 40 years old, he looked on that and he saw an Egyptian taskmaster that was beating an Israelite slave. And thinking that it was their means of deliverance, he slew the Egyptian taskmaster. And this brought him in bad situation with the Pharaoh, who wanted to kill Moses. So he fled to the land of Midian. Just a second. Allergies are at 11 right now. I heard everybody sniffing and what have you. And that moves us to the second period of Moses' life. So the second period of Moses' life only is about 4 verses. Basically, he goes to the land of Midian. He marries a woman named Zipporah and becomes a shepherd working for his father-in-law. Who's his father-in-law? Speak up when you speak. Jethro. I hear voices, just not what they're saying. Thank you. Jethro. Jethro will show back later whenever they're in the Exodus, right? Moses goes and says, "Jethro, help me out. I can't handle these people." And so that's the second period of Moses' life. Now we move into the third period of Moses' life. And here's where the videotape really slows down pretty much to real time, right? We start having lots of text covering things. So in Exodus chapter 3 now, if you're following along, we see that God speaks to Moses. God has heard the cries of the people in Egypt. And he says, hey, Moses, through a burning bush, I got a plan. Oh, and by the way, this plan involves you going to Pharaoh and talking him into allowing the people to leave. Set my people free, right? And so we have this burning bush, this plan delivered to Moses, and God addresses himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And let's take a little sidestep, because we need to remember that it's been about 400 years since God's directly interacted with any of the patriarchs, right? So it's been kind of a silent period. And so these Israelites have been in captivity in the land of Goshen. They've been working from sunup to sundown and beyond. They have been absolutely exhausted trying to scrape together bricks. And I suspect at this point in time, the idea of God had been somewhat lost in a lot of the people. And so God, in speaking to Abraham, to Moses, says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so he tells him, he says, I know about Israel's sufferings in verse 7. He hasn't forgotten them. And he hasn't forgotten his promise that he made all those years ago to Abraham back in Genesis that we just read about, along with the promises of land, seed, and nation. But Moses realizes that their deliverance from Egypt is all on his shoulders, sort of. So when he hears this plan that he's going to be the one that leads the journey and will stand before Pharaoh and will deliver the people out of Egypt, he says, hold on. I'm not the right guy. And he takes a little bit of convincing. And can you imagine? Can you imagine? Okay. God coming to you and saying, you're going to go stand before Pharaoh. And you're going to tell Pharaoh, let these people go. And Pharaoh's going to look at you and laugh, right? So you can imagine the intrepidation that Moses had in hearing this and considering it. The problem was Moses hadn't really understood just how God was going to be with him yet. And so God's got some teaching to do with Moses as well. However, he tells him with some help of his brother Aaron, he'll get through it, and Moses listens to God and goes to Pharaoh with the message, let my people go. So we're now in Exodus chapter 5. So in Exodus chapter 5, Moses goes back to Egypt. Now the Pharaoh that wanted to kill Moses is dead. So a new Pharaoh has arisen, and so Moses is okay with going back. And now he has this task to go and see Pharaoh and tell him some things that Pharaoh is not going to want to hear. So God has decided that he will redeem and deliver Israel from Egypt with 10 plagues. These are miraculous acts of God. And what we need to understand, there's several purposes for these plagues. The first one, remember when we read about the promise to Abraham, he said, I will judge these people. So one of the purposes of these plagues is the pronouncement of judgment on Egypt. Okay, and you can see that we're in Exodus 5 in verses 22 and 23. So it's going to be judgment against the nation that is oppressing his people. It's also to declare to Egypt and the world that he is God, the I Am. And this is in response to a pretty bold claim from Pharaoh. In chapter 5, verse 2, Pharaoh says, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go. Pretty bold statement. Not surprising, Pharaoh considered himself a god. And so he says, I don't even know who this God I am is. And so I am Pharaoh, a god, and we have all these other gods. And so I don't need this God. I will not let them go. So God intends to declare clearly to Egypt, to Pharaoh, and to the Israelites that He is God. He is sovereign. Remember, it's been 400 years. So He's doing a little teaching with Israel along the way here, right? He needs to instill in them faith and confidence and trust so that they will follow Him and go to the promised land. He also wants to lead Israel out to a better condition. Remember, one of the promises He gave to Abraham is that whenever they came out, they would have prosperity. Well, they're slaves. They have nothing. He promised prosperity. Now, God could have chosen any way to prosper His people that He wanted. You know, we look at how God does things in the Bible, and we look at it and we kind of wonder sometimes, right? But it's really not up to us to question God. God has His means and His purpose, and I believe, ultimately, that He chose these 10 plagues. Number one, to clearly demonstrate to Egypt, to Pharaoh, and to the Israelites that He was God, as we've already said. But number two, I believe that the purpose was so that at the very end, Pharaoh would say, get out of here and take whatever you want. And so they wouldn't be stealing, if you will. And this is how God intends to ultimately prosper His people, is through these plagues. And then ultimately He wants, and understand, as we walk through the Bible, we not only see a God that pronounces judgment, we see a God that also shows mercy and grace throughout the Old Testament. And we'll see this theme repeated throughout the Old Testament. God wanted to give Egypt and Pharaoh an opportunity to listen and obey. You see, ultimately, Pharaoh could have heard even at the first plague, even at the first request, and said, you know what? I hear this God, and I'm going to obey. I'll let the people go. But he chose not to. The Bible says Pharaoh hardened his heart. So God has given Egypt and Pharaoh many opportunities to listen and obey. And even though the plagues were a form of judgment, in them He is also showing grace and patience through all these 10 plagues and through the message that Moses is given to Pharaoh to let His people go. And this is one of the themes that runs through the plagues. This constant struggle between God and Pharaoh's hardened heart. And every time God presents an opportunity, what does Pharaoh do? He hardens his heart. And the message there, we should not look at Pharaoh and go, silly guy. The message is, let us not harden our heart as Pharaoh did. Let us be soft and open to God's word and let it come inside of us and transform us and change us. And let us not be like Pharaoh. We're doing pretty good on time. I'm going to stop for a minute. Any questions or comments up to this point? We're going to talk a little bit about the plagues. I see no hands. All right. So when we look at the plagues, we see threes again. Remember, we saw threes in the life of Moses, three periods of 40 years. Here we see several threes. The plagues kind of align themselves into three sets plus one outlier. Because 10 divided by 3 is not even, right? My engineering mind. So, 3 sets of 3. So, the first set is turning the Nile to blood, the frogs, and the lice. The lice. I can't count fingers. The second set is flies, animal diseases, and boils. And then the third set is the hail, the locust, and the darkness. Within these sets, the first two of the plagues are announced. So they're announced to Pharaoh by Moses. But the third plague of the set happens. Kind of interesting arrangement. One, two, bam. So God goes through Moses to Pharaoh, in each case twice, says, hey, look at this. And then the third time he says, bam. And this happens three times. In the first set of plagues, the magicians of Pharaoh could replicate the plague. So they had the sleight of hand and magic and whatever to replicate these things. When it comes to the fourth through the sixth plagues, we see a distinction introduced. So when you look at like the flies and the animal diseases and the boils, we see that the plague happened to Egypt, but not to the children of Israel. And then when we come to the third set, nothing really outstanding in that. However, also understand that each of these plagues has a very specific purpose. So remember, God is teaching. And God's given Egypt an opportunity to repent and to come to Him. And each one of these plagues addresses a specific God of Egypt. And in every case, God is showing He is mightier than these 10 gods of Egypt. So, as an example, there's Happy, the god of the Nile, H-A-P-I, not H-A-P-P-Y. There's Hequit, the god of fertility that had the head of a frog, so when the frogs plague. So each one of those is some aspect of a god. But there's one plague that stands out as unique from the rest. Remember, after the first set of three, there was distinction. And it was easy to see when the plague would happen that there was a distinction. The Israelites didn't do anything to bring about the distinction. I mean, it was easy to see when the plague of the animal diseases hit, the next morning you wake up and your stock is alive and their stock is dead, you know there's a distinction. Whenever there are boils on the Egyptians but not on the Israelites, it's pretty easy to see. They didn't do anything specific. When the darkness pervades over Egypt, but not in the house of Israel, that's pretty easy to tell. But nothing that the Israelites did brought about that distinction. That was God that created that distinction. When we come to the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, there's some interesting aspects, but one of the aspects is now Israel will take part in being that distinction. And we understand what that part they take is, right? There's the whole lamb and the feast and the blood on the lintel and the doorpost, right? So they do all of this as promised by God, and the angel will pass over that house, right? So Israel now has to express something. They have to express faith through obedience. They have to go out. They have to select the lamb. They have to prepare it. They have to take the blood and put it on, and they have to prepare the feast and partake of the feast as was instructed to them. So now Israel has to do something. They have to express belief in God. So remember, one of the purposes of these plagues was to ultimately tell Israel, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they're getting the message. As you go through the Exodus, you understand that they don't have it fully yet. Another interesting thing about this particular one that we don't see anywhere else in the plagues, in chapter 11 and verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, "Yet one plague more I will bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. And afterward, he will let you go from here. And when he lets you go, he will drive you away completely." So it was told beforehand that this plague would be the one. That this would be the one that would drive Pharaoh to let the people go. God knew that this would be it. This would be the last straw. After this plague, Pharaoh would be done and let them go. This plague was the work of God. There was no part of Aaron and Moses in this. There was no rods being lifted up, no dust being thrown. This was God alone, judgment upon Egypt. And again, Israel was distinct. But they were distinct because now they had a part in it. They had a part that they had to play. They had to express faith and obedience through following the instructions that they were given. What's interesting about the 10th plague is that it becomes something that becomes a part of Israel for the rest of the history of Israel. And it even has fingers into what we do today. That 10th plague became something that they should remember. That it was more than just the death of the firstborn. It represented deliverance. It represented that the people were set free through this plague. And it was to become an annual, perpetual memorial for God's people. And this is where, in Exodus chapter 12, we see the establishment of the Passover. It's called the Passover because the angel passed over. It spared the firstborn in any home that had the blood sacrifice of the lamb over the lintel of the door. Deliverance, sacrifice, lamb, blood. Don't forget those. So since that first Passover in Egypt, it's always been celebrated on the 14th day of the first month, as we see in Exodus chapter 12 in verse 18. So this brings us to that morning where Pharaoh arises and there is death across his kingdom, even his own son, the cattle. And he wakes up and he says, "Get out of here. Go. Take whatever you need and go." So finally the children of Israel are free from Pharaoh and they leave Egypt with the wealth of the Egyptians, and with something else. What else did they take with them when they left? The bones of Joseph. We go all the way back to the end of Egypt, Genesis again. Remember, Joseph said, "Take my bones with you when you leave." It didn't take Jacob's bones because they had already taken him back, right? But Joseph said, "Take my bones when you leave." And here, at least 400 years later, they do as he requested. So they plunder Egypt, take their wealth, and the bones of Joseph. And it is a celebration day until they get to the Red Sea. Because Pharaoh, after kicking them out, changes his mind. And he says, "How are we going to get all these bricks made without these slaves?" He says, "I better go get these back. People are going to rebel against me if I make them go make bricks." So he gathers up his army and he takes out pursuing Israel. And he's hot on the tail of Israel, right? and they come face to face with the Red Sea, and they're pressed between this army of Egypt behind them and this blocking sea ahead of them with a million people and all their animal and their heavy gold and riches that they're carrying with them. And they go, what do we do? And God, through Moses, parts the sea. And they cross on dry land. Oh, what an amazing thing that must have been. If you've seen the movie rendition of it, you look at that and you go, that just doesn't even begin to touch the hem of the skirt of how incredible that must have been to walk through the bed of that sea on dry land with all the water piled up around you. So they cross the sea, and Pharaoh says, ha, look at that. That doesn't do anything. I'm right after them. He heads down into the seabed and is pursuing them. And when they come out the other side, when Israel comes out the other side, Moses turns, and God, through Moses, closes the waters over the Egyptian army. The people are free. God has delivered his people. Egypt's been defeated by Jehovah God. So let's understand a thread that really walks through all of this. Egypt has been defeated not by the might of the Israelites, not by the strength of leadership of Moses, although Moses was a strong leader. They have been delivered. They have been freed. Egypt has been destroyed by the might of God. That is something that God wanted them to clearly take in and implant into them. And with the Passover, remember every year so they would not forget that. Why does God want them to remember that? Why do you think God instituted the Passover? I'm going to stop and let y'all talk. Right. You remember whenever they crossed the Nile, not the Nile, the Jordan, when they were going into the land? They stopped and they erected stones. God wants us to remember him. And he wants to remember what he's done for us. And so the Passover was created so that as they lived their life year by year, hundreds of years, thousands of years, that they would not forget what God has done for them. And he's done the same thing for us. Every Sunday, well, we don't use that table much anymore, but every Sunday we remember what Jesus has done for us, how he delivered us from sin. Because living this life, it's easy for us to just get overwhelmed with everything. And we need to be reminded. After centuries of awaiting, the promises that God made to Abraham are on their way to being fulfilled. Two of the promises. One is already fulfilled. Exodus 12, verse 37, numbers the people at 600,000 men. If we include women and children, that was well over a million people. His descendants have become a mighty nation. And through the leadership of Moses, that nation, Israel, will take a journey to the promised land to claim Canaan as their own. And it's kind of, in a way, a sad journey, as we well know the story. And that what should have been a very relatively short journey, actually, ended up being 40 years. What takes place in the rest of Exodus in the book of Deuteronomy tells us that story, that journey to the promised land. It records the leadership of Moses, the good things and his failings. It records the law that God gave Israel. And it tells us about the preparation that they made for their conquest of Canaan. and the law was given to them. So they leave and they come to the mount. And we know all the stories around that, of all the problems they had with it, but ultimately God takes Moses up on the mountain and he gives them his law. The Ten Commandments, we call it. And with all the problems of that, we see that the law was there for a couple of purposes. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6, here in Deuteronomy chapter 6, Moses is restating the Ten Commandments to the people. And in verse 5, he says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." The law had a purpose. We see this paralleled in Jesus whenever he is asked, "What is the greatest command?" And in Mark chapter 12 and verse 30, when he replies, he says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." Quoting back what God, through Moses, had told the people back in Deuteronomy. So the question is how do you love God?
Keep his commandments.
If you love me, you will do what? Keep my commandments. So let's understand, contrary to a lot of the gobbledygook we hear today, loving God is not a fuzzy little warm, "Oh, this feels so good" feeling. Yes, when we think about what he's done for us, we certainly feel that. But fundamentally, when God says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments," what God is interested in is us submitting ourselves to his rule. And whenever he talks about the Ten Commandments, the first half of them are about our relationship with God. And so when he says, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul," he's saying, in this is the law. How do we love God? We follow the commandments that he gave. We do. We have to show that he is supreme in our life by doing what he says. So God gave his people a law so they could understand what it means to love God. But there's a second half to that that Jesus says, if you recall. He says the first is the greatest is to love the Lord your God. But he says the second is like, get it? Love your neighbor as yourself. And on these two hang the whole of the commandments. Love God, love your neighbor. So the second purpose of law is to teach us to love people. When he said in Mark 12, "Love your neighbor as yourself," he's quoting something straight out of Leviticus 19, verse 18. So how do you show your neighbor you love them? So think about the second half of the commandments, right? All right, you're going to steal from them? Are you going to lie? Cheat? Are you going to... That's just wrong. We can't have that little time. Okay, so you get the point. And then the final thing that Moses covers in verse 18, he says, when you're loving God and you're loving your neighbor according to the law, the result is that you will live well. And so he says in 6:18, "Do what is right and good in the Lord's sight, so that it may be well with you, and you may go in and take over the good land that the Lord has promised as an oath to your forefathers." God wants us to live a good life, to be the right kind of people, to develop the right kind of society. And how do they do so? They follow the law. I'm going to skip a section here. There's a lot of references to the Exodus in Scripture. But we're just going to have to skip that because I want to get to the point. Jesus in the Exodus. Okay, so where do you see Jesus in the story of the Exodus? Mark? Exactly. Yeah, so we had that parallel of the killing of the male children. What else? Yeah. Yeah. So you have the slaves, the deliverance, the... Yeah, good. What else? Tony? Exactly. That's even talked about in Hosea, right? Good. Let me give you a mic. Blood. I was just fixing to give that as a hint. What about the blood? Blood of the lamb, right? The lamb. What about that? The lamb, right? Do we see Jesus called the lamb? We have the Passover lamb. We have the blood associated with it. What else is associated with the lamb? It's a perfect, unblemished, spotless lamb, right? Firstborn. What else? There's another one. Huh? A 1 year old, okay. Bones. What about bones? What was specified about the lamb? Shouldn't be halt or broken, right? What was prophesied about Jesus? None of his bones would be broken, right? Okay. There was another one. Oh. Through his death, many will be saved. Think about 40 years and 400 years and 40 days. What happened before Jesus gave his law? He went in the wilderness, right? After he's baptized, what does he do? He goes in the wilderness. How long is he in the wilderness? How long did it take him to get from Egypt to the mount? To the mount. About 40 days. You have 40 days journey there. Jesus went in the wilderness 40 days. At the end of his temptation, he's up on a mountain. And that is the point that he launches into giving his time, his law. What else? Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's see, did I miss any? Okay, Paul calls Jesus our Passover lamb, our propitiation. It's all with the idea of deliverance that has been talked about. Yeah. Very good. So just one couple other and then we'll end. Remember with the Passover, Israel had to empty their house of leaven. Titus chapter 2, 11 through 14 talks about the leaven of sin and how sin can destroy with the same effectiveness as just a little bit of leaven in a lump of dough. And so we're supposed to empty our hearts of the leaven of sin. we didn't get to talk about the parallels of the Passover and the Lord's Supper. God redeemed Israel. And God has redeemed us through the blood of the Lamb. Through the first Lamb and the law that was established, we see priests. Through the Lamb of Jesus Christ, we become priests. Thank y'all.